Well, first I would like to thank the organizers of the conference to inviting me, here. So this is an old title, it doesn't match exactly the official title of this for this talk, but the only difference is that I removed the diagonal disorder and make it look a bit more relevant to the conference. And but I'll only talk really about off-diagonal disorder, and I'll tell you at the end why it's relevant to superconductivity, superconducting quantum wires. Now, my collaborators on the part on off-diagonal disorder are listed here. Akira is in the audience, and the work done on superconducting quantum wires, benefited from the help of Ilya Grusberg, who is also here. So the problem I would like to talk about today is this can be summed in the following way. It's motivated by the classification of all universality class in the problem of Anderson localization. And first thing, what do I mean by Anderson localization? Well, Anderson in 1958 asked the question, what is the return probability for a quantum particle hopping on a lattice in a random on-site potential? And more generally, we would like to understand, under localization theory, we would like to understand the statistical properties of the eigenvalues of some random Hamiltonian or the statistical properties of the eigenfunctions of this random Hamiltonian. Here, this Hamiltonian describes a single particle in the presence of a random environment which is static in time, hence only varies in space. Now, this concept of a single particle extends to quasi-particles. Quasi-particles in a Fermi liquid, BCS quasi-particles, phonons, photons, spin waves. So what you can imagine is that you have an interacting theory, you do some infield theory, you get some non-interacting approximation to your interacting theory with some quasi-particles that do not interact, and then you can always ask the question, what happens if I put static disorder in the problem? Well, but the important thing is that I am always neglecting interactions, and this might not be relevant in the true world. So the other key word is universality. Why do I talk about universality? Well, naively, you might distinguish a regime where the disorder is strong and a regime where the disorder is weak. Naively, again, if the disorder is strong, you might expect that short-distance physics dominates non-universality rules. Whereas if disorder is weak, you might hope that there exists a new length scale in the problem at very long length scale called the localization length. And this localization length might be much larger than some microscopic scale that defines the strength of the disorder, this weak disorder. And if this is so, then you might hope that there is a regime of length scale between where you can universality might manifest itself. So if there is such what will control universality? Well, dimensionality will control it, and also symmetries. The symmetries, the intrinsic symmetries of your microscopic Hamiltonian, namely the presence or absence of transversal symmetry, spin symmetry, something which I call here chirality, which we'll define more precisely later on, particle symmetry, if you talk about, here I have in mind particle symmetry induced if you have a pairing, a la BCS, for example, and you could imagine other type of symmetries popping out in the problem. Now, from this point of view, the first 20 years or 30 years spent studying the problem of Anderson localization essentially boiled down to studying a very special subset of possible intrinsic symmetries, and I will refer to those symmetries as the standard universality classes. And they were simply obtained by having or not having either time-versal invariance or spin symmetry. And so there are three classes. You can have no time-versal symmetry, and you don't care what happens in the spin sector. And this is called unitary ensemble conventionally, and denoted by convention by this beta equal to 2. You can have time-versal invariance, but spin symmetry will be broken. This is referred to the symplectic ensemble, and conventionally people use the notation beta equal to 4. Or you can have time-versal symmetry and spin symmetry. You talk about the orthogonal ensemble, beta is equal to 1. So in those standard universality classes, if you look at the density of state on average, you find that it is a smooth function of energy. Nothing happens with the density of state. It's a rather boring quantity. And if you want to probe the question of Anderson, what is the return probability of a particle in this random environment, in those universality class, you have to look at conductance to see if there is some kind of delocalization to answer the question whether the particles is forced to return or if the particle is allowed to never return to its original point. And if I was to take here a plot of the density of state as a function of energy, I would draw a very smooth curve, bell-shaped like that. And depending on the dimensionality of space and depending on the symmetries, the free symmetries here, I will be able to distinguish a regime where typically the wave function, if it is, let's say, it corresponds to density that is red in this regime here, typically the wave function will be extended, whereas if you look at very extreme energies, either very small or very large, typically the wave function will correspond to the blue region of the density of state, the typical wave function will be localized. Now, in between this regime in energy, where the density of state is colored in blue and in red, just at the there is a critical point, and this critical point is an example of a continuous phase transition. Now, in this plot of the density of state, you saw that in order to have a difference, in order to see the localization, you needed the desire not to be too strong, and you needed the dimensionality of space to be sufficiently large. In fact, in one dimension, there is no delocalization at all. A particle is always strongly localized. One dimension from this point of view is rather boring. However, if you study the problem of quasi-1D, even though you are going to find a localization, you are still going to be able to probe the property of universality. So what do I mean by quasi-1D? I mean a situation where, imagine a particle hopping on this lattice, which is much longer than it is large. And what can happen if the numbers of channels, here the numbers of chains, is quite large, what can happen is that you can be in a situation where the length of the chain, L, is much larger than the mean free path, which measures the strength of the disorder on a macroscopic scale. And a new length scale that emerges in the problem at long length scale, xi, the localization length. And if you're in a situation where this hierarchy of length scale holds, then you are going to observe with some quantities, you can measure conductance fluctuations, and then you'll see that those conductance fluctuations do not depend on any macroscopic details of the problem. And you can talk about universality. Now, evidently, you are guaranteed in quasi-1D to reach a localized regime as soon as the length of the wire is much longer than the localization length. Now, quasi-1D is interesting also because it is a logical intermediate between when you want to try numerically to study, for example, a two-dimensional system. Two-dimensional system is interesting because it is kind of a critical dimension in the standard universality class of Anderson. And if you want to study two dimension, well, you can build the system in there. When you put it on a computer, you can really do a scaling analysis where you take very long wires and then you just add more and more chains. Another advantage of quasi-1D is that exact solutions, as is often the case in lower dimensionality, are available. So I would like to stress that for the standard universality class, in quasi-1D geometry, you always have localization at very long length scale. This will not be the case in the random hopping problem that I now define. So the random hopping problem is defined as the following way. Imagine that you have a lattice, which is a square lattice. So you can draw some of the sides in red and the other sides in blue. And now you define your random Hamiltonian in such a way that you only have hopping between the red sides and between a red and a blue side. And this hopping amplitude, the Tij here, is a random number, is some random number. You can allow for a spin flip denoted by the possibility that new here change during the hopping process. So this I define as a random hopping problem, and it is a special problem because compared to the standard problem of Anderson localization, which is depicted here, where my lattice, the same lattice, is simply drawn here with black sites, it is a special problem because with this definition of the hopping amplitude, you are guaranteed that whenever you change the sign of the wave function on every blue sides only, and leave the wave function unchanged on the red sides, you are guaranteed that the Hamiltonian is going to change sign. So this means that all the energy eigenvalues for any given realizations of those hopping amplitudes, all the energy eigenvalues are going to come in pairs. There will be, if there is a plus energy eigenvalue for a given realization of the T's here, there is a minus value of this eigenvalue in the spectrum. And then the center of the band, epsilon equal to zero, which is a symmetry point of the energy eigenvalue spectrum, is going to play a very special role in this problem, as we will see. Now, this is a very fragile symmetry compared to the problem of, it's a very fragile symmetry because you can immediately destroy the symmetry as soon as you allow hopping between the red sides. Let's say a diagonal hopping here. That's one way to break it. You evidently break it if you allow to have on-site disorder. So this is a term of that form here. If you were to impose periodic boundary conditions, let's say in the transverse direction, well, if you had a not numbers of chain, then periodic boundary conditions in the transverse direction will break also the symmetry. So you have to be careful when you do numerics. If you want to study this random hopping problem, you have to be careful with the boundary conditions that you choose. So although there is considerably less work has been done on this random hopping problem, nevertheless, it dates back to a very long time ago. The first to study it on a single chain was Dyson in 1953. Dyson in 1953 essentially studied this problem, although he was thinking of random random phonons. But he showed that the density of states for the single chain random hopping problem was divergent at the band center. Now, this singularity, I will call in the rest of the talk the Dyson singularity, and I will give you an analytic form for this singularity. And it was realized in the 70s that this singularity in this problem of electron hopping on the single, nearest neighbor hopping on the single chain was closely related to special properties of quantum spin chains that are random. There was also a connection, so if you have a random hopping problem on a single chain, you can ask what happens if I put dimerization in the problem. So in the clean limit, what if I had a very small gap in the clean limit due to some staggering of the hopping amplitude, and then now you put some randomness on top of that. And the first people apparently to have studied this problem in a different context, but effectively studying this problem, were Lee, Rice, and Anderson, that proposed that the hard gap in the clean system would turn into a pseudo gap upon adding some disorder. And actually this pseudo gap was calculated exactly by Ovchinnikov and Ehrlichman in 1977. All those examples deal with the density of states for a single chain problem, and we had to wait for the work of Gade in 1993 to look at what happens on a square lattice and in truly two dimension. And she found that the density of state was also singular at the band center in two dimension.
The Ovchinnikov and company's work was stopped, essentially assuming some particular model.
Yeah, so I have not defined precisely the model. So it was random hopping with uncorrelated white noise disorder, and that's crucial. You have to be, so one has to, if we, so one has to be, that's an essential assumption in the model. If you have long range, well, if you have a very smooth distribution of disorder, the physics here changes. So I'm talking about the long-range correlations, special, if you have special correlations of a disorder. If you have long-range special correlations, it is very smooth. You can imagine that this is going to change the physics. Now, Gade was assuming white noise, uncorrelated, well, white noise disorder, which involves Gaussian, which everybody does for simplicity. Okay, so And evidently, well, you might imagine that this choice is not essential to the physics. If she had chosen something with higher cumulants, as long as it is uncorrelated in space, the physics will not change that much.
No, let's say that the gradient is presumably calculating the singularity since just gets at the critical point. So it's thinking to be universal, while the other case we're calculating off criticality, so depending on the details of the distribution, much more so than the gradient.
They only consider dimerized? Is that what you're referring to, Chernikov?
Yeah,
they didn't consider the non-dimerized
case. No, yeah, that's what I just read though.
Yeah, I'm talking about putting them in. So now I'd like to present our results and then try to give you some intuition how we derive them. So our results are here presented for the localization regime. We are valid for the random hopping problem along n chains of length L. So the length L is much longer than the width for the system. The color code is to remind you that there is this sublattice symmetry. And you have to distinguish what happens far away from the band center and at the band center, or the vicinity of the band center. And what we find is that there is a parity effect, a dependence on the on whether or not the number n of chains is odd or even, both in the density of state and the conductance. So close to the band center, if you calculate the density of state, let's look first at the case of and not numbers of chains, so five chains instead of four as depicted here, what we find is the Dyson singularity. You find that there is a divergence upon approaching the band center, like 1 over the energy, epsilon, and there is this suppression factor, logarithmic suppression factor, log to the power 3. So that's what we find when n is odd. When n is even, you find a algebraic suppression of the density of state as you approach the band center with an exponent that depends on the symmetry. So I remind you that if beta is equal to 4, this is a situation when you have transversal symmetry but no spin rotation symmetry, that's the chiral symplectic ensemble. Beta equal to 2 is a situation where you have no transversal symmetry at all, that's the chiral unitary class. And the last example, or the last case, is when beta is equal to 1, that's a chiral orthogonal class. And you see that beta equal to 1 is very interesting because actually what happens is that the suppression factor vanishes and you're just left with this factor here, which is a logarithmic divergence. So what are the implications of this diverging density of state from the point of view of localization theory? Can we say, just looking at the density of state, can we conclude that the system is delocalized? Unfortunately, you cannot from the density of state as soon as you have more than one chain, because you cannot relate directly the density of state for strictly non-one-dimensional system to the localization length. So you have to go and calculate the conductance to see if the conductance is also sensitive to this difference between the n odd and n even, and if even the conductance will tell you that there is some kind of delocalization going on. So let's compute the conductance, or rather, let's compute something which is expected to be well-behaved as a statistical random variable. Let's compute the log of the conductance, or the probability distribution of the log of the conductance, or the average of the log of the conductance. So maybe you expect that the log of the conductance is going to be self-averaging. With longer and longer system size, you would expect that the conductance, the log of the conductance, fluctuate less and less. Is it true? Well, if you look at the case of n odd, you find that the average of the log of the conductance scales like the square root of L, the length of the system. And then you are going to calculate the variance of the log of the conductance, and you'll find that it scales like the L. So the root mean square deviation squares like square root of L, which is of the same order as the mean conductance. So it tells you that for the case of an odd numbers of chain, the log of the conductance is not self-averaging. It is a very strongly, it is a random variable that is very broadly distributed. That's contrary to the naive expectation coming from the standard universality class. And what is this naive expectation? Well, it is realized when n is even. When n is even, the log of g to leading order in L is proportional to L, which when compared to the variance of log of g, you immediately infer that indeed the root mean square root deviations are square root of, 1 over square root of L smaller than the average, so these appear in the Chernobyl limit. Indeed, the log of g for the case of n even is a self-averaging random variable. And you see that there is a length scale that appears in the problem, psi, in green here, and this length scale here could be interpreted, would be interpreted, or has to be interpreted as the localization length. But in the case of n odd, this length scale psi has to be thought as a crossover length scale. And this length scale psi that emerges at longer distances, longer than the mean free path little l here, is related to little l here by this relationship where beta is the symmetry index, 1, 2, or 4, and is numbers of chains in the problem.
Good question. For the case where n is even and you're actually exponentially localized, one might have thought that the density of states near the band center wasn't actually universal. But perhaps in some highly disordered limit where it might become close to being universal, one might have thought it would coincide with random matrix theory.
Yes.
And does it? I mean, I don't know.
So random matrix theory is this prediction here.
So what are the logs?
The log, I will explain where it comes from. But this actually is a prediction of random matrix theory, and actually the best way, there is a very simple way to see it. You take a 2x2 matrix, or 4x4 if you want to include spin, and you impose the constraint that it is a chiral random matrix, and you just count how many parameters have to be tuned off the diagonal elements, and you find that it is beta minus 1, namely 3, 1 or 0, depending on the symmetries. So that's how you get the scaling exponent here. And if you did a real calculation, you'll get a result which falls asymptotically will give you this parallel suppression.
But you're going to tell us to what extent the log is insensitive to microscopic details?
Yes, well, yeah. Mm-hmm. So now I gave you the results. Let's try to give you an intuition of how I derived them. So there are two approaches to the problem. One is a lattice model, which simply describes nearest neighbor hopping, and the hopping amplitude is random. And this line is meant to ease the definition of a nearest neighbor hopping problem on a on this in this quantum wire geometry. So again, the symmetry, the sublattice symmetry gives you this chirality. That's what the sublattice symmetry I dub as chirality in this problem. And it's present if you make sure that you have open boundary conditions in transverse direction, and that and since I am only considering nearest neighbor hopping on a square lattice or on a rectangular lattice, and there is no onside disorder, I automatically have this symmetry. So I stress here it's nearest neighbor hopping and it's random. Actually, the average value of the hopping in the transverse direction and the average value of the hopping in the longitudinal direction don't have to be the same. We have played with that, and then the width of the disorder about those values can be different, but it's nearest neighbor hopping only, microscopically. All the results that I showed on the previous page, they are obtained exactly for this continuum model. And actually, this model is quite different from this one. It's very different from this one. The only thing the two models share in common is the existence of the chiral symmetry. So how do I define the continuum model? Well, I imagine that first I have those n chains, and they are uncoupled, and there is no disorder. So I have n chains that are not coupled by a t-perp, and I just have a t in this direction. And because I am each chain is a one-dimensional system, and I'm interested in the band center, I'm going to do linearization, and I get the kinetic energy close to the band center at half filling, and this is simply this term here. So sigma 3 is telling you that there are right movers and left movers. Implicitly here, there is an n-bind matrix because I have n uncoupled chains. that I am not writing explicitly, y is the position along the chain. And now I am going to put the disorder, assuming that it is weak disorder, so that the fact that I did linearization here is not destroyed by too much too strong disorder. And then I'm going simply to do what? Well, I'm going to, this is a Hamiltonian, which is a 2n by 2n Hamiltonian, and hence I have to add the most general 2n by 2n matrix that is consistent with the existence of a sublattice symmetry in some microscopic model. And it's easy to do that. You just add a Pauli matrix sigma 3 multiplied by n by n matrix V. You add the Pauli matrix sigma 2 multiplied by n by n matrix W. And if you do that and you don't add so what you are leaving out of the problem is sigma 0 times some other n by n matrix and sigma 3 times some other matrix. If you added those two other terms, you will get the standard universality class. We don't do that. We only keep this type of disorder. And then, surely enough, we see that this random Hamiltonian anti-commutes with sigma 1. And this anti-commutation is essentially a realization in the continuum of this symmetry here. Now we have to specify the statistical properties of the disorder. And what do we do? Well, those n by matrix, V and W, all the entries are equally likely, equally random. There is no difference between them, except that in some cases we have to distinguish between we have to distinguish whether we have transversal symmetry, spin-Olchersen symmetry. So if they are equally likely, you will have, when you compute the variance, you will have a term like that or like that. And if you want to distinguish between the free symmetry class, I mean, transversal symmetry and spin rotation symmetry, you have to include some, if you want the fact that some of the, if you had orthogonal case, all the entries of those metrics have to be real, and so they are not all independent, so you have to add those terms here. So here comes the specification of the free symmetry class. Beta runs from 1, is 1, 2, or 4. And otherwise, we have all the entries of the matrix are equally likely. And then in space, along the position of the wire, we have white noise correlations because we put a delta function. And the disorder strength appears here as xi. And xi is this crossover length scale that I defined earlier. So that's the continuum model for which we have exact results. And since we are interested in the reflection, since we want to calculate the density of state or the conductance, we're going to attack the calculation of those two quantities by studying the statistical properties of the reflection matrix. So R is a reflection matrix, and if you want to calculate the density out of R, you use this formula where the reflection matrix is defined like that. Here you have your disordered wire, but at the right side, right end, it is you have a perfectly reflecting wall. So your plane wave comes here and then goes into the disordered region, scatters, do whatever you want, but ultimately has to bounce back and come out here. So the incoming plane wave on the left is reflected by the reflection matrix at energy epsilon into the outgoing plane wave on the left. Hence, in this geometry, R, this reflection matrix, has to be unitary. And if it is unitary, you only care about its phases, eigenphases. And then out of the eigenphases, using this formula, which is a generalization of what you will do when in the node counting theorem for a single chain problem, you get the density of state here. Now, if you want to compute the conductance, then what you do is that, yes?
Can you give some sort of this hand waving?
Yes. So essentially, well, actually, if you just wait 2 seconds or maybe one or two transparencies, I will illustrate to you. I will do it a bit later. You'll get some more feeling about it. Okay? Now if you wanted to calculate the conductance, then what you will do is that you simply look at this open geometry. This other region here, perfect leads on the left and the right. Incoming plane wave, either it goes through or it reflects. And whatever goes through is the goes through defines the conductance, but it can be expressed in terms of the reflection matrix via this relationship. So now the question of how to calculate the density of state and the conductance reduces to studying the statistical properties of this reflection matrix.
Chris, sorry, but when you have the right hand side open, then R is not anymore unitary.
R is not unitary, and that's why 1 minus R dagger R gives you T dagger T. So T dagger T.
But what I'm saying,
when you write your DMPK or whatever,
yes.
R,
yeah.
Is it the same for both cases or not?
No, it's not the same.
Okay.
Well, yeah, there are differences. But since I'm... So now that I have reduced the problem to understanding the statistical properties of the reflection matrix, let's use some kind of, let's use the linearization group approach. Imagine that you have a disordered region of length L here, and imagine that you add a very small slice of disorder of width delta L. Now your disordered region of length L is characterized by this reflection matrix R, and then the question is how does R change when you add this small slice of disorder. So composition laws are given here, and this is an exact relationship, it is simply optics if you want. But now you want to calculate the change of the reflection matrix R, and you want to express it in terms of the statistical properties of the statistical properties of this small slice here, R1, R1 prime, T1, T1 prime, that's R1 is reflection from the left, reflection from the right, and so on. And you do that within the bound approximation. So you calculate the change of, so you calculate the total change here, and you do it, so you express those guys here within, to second order in the disorder. And the disorder here is either W or V, where W, capital W, is related to the little W of the model, a microscopic model, like here and like here. Okay? So the input is what? The input is a perturbation expansion, a calculation of the statistical properties of this small slice here. And to do that, to justify this input, I have to assume that the disorder is weak. So I have to assume that the mean free path is much larger than delta L. In turn, delta L has to be much larger than the lattice spacing for the continuum theory to be a good approximation. So let's apply this to the calculation of the density of states. So in the geometry of appropriate to the calculation of density of state, my reflection matrix is unitary. Initially, by that I mean the length of the disordered region is zero, my reflection matrix is a unit matrix because everything goes through, there is no disorder. Now, well, not true, but everything bounces back and there is no problem. Now, the unitarity of my reflection matrix is preserved by the RG flow, and I'm going to write R as the exponential of a phase matrix, phi, and I'm going to just translate the RG step for R into an RG step for phi. And so the RG step is the following. My cotangent of phi divided by 2 becomes this cotangent, where now I have shifted my angle matrix by the energy epsilon, and the disorder appears here and here. So let's look now at the case of no disorder, just to get a feeling for the meaning of this formula and answer Santiago's question. So you see that the effect of having a finite energy is to change by a constant increment the eigenphase of this reflection matrix. In other words, as you increase the system size, your phis are going to move at a constant rate around the circle. Now, if you sit at a point and you just count how many times a phi is going through, well, essentially this counts how many eigenstates below energy epsilon you have. And since the rate at which you are moving, the phis are all moving, is proportional to energy, that gives you the total energy is epsilon, and if you calculate the density of state, you differentiate and you get a constant density of state close to the band center. This is what you expect, this is what you should find if you do it by other means. Now the difference, now what happens if you switch on disorder? Well, if you switch on disorder, instead of having a nice constant motion, all of the eigenvalues phi around the circle, you get some kind of random motion, or some kind of random motion. Sometimes the phis move like that, sometimes they move like that. So now we're going to try to quantify this Brownian motion to extract the density of state out of it. And instead of working in the phi representation, which is perfectly legal, but we find it more convenient to essentially do a mapping in the complex plane and turn the phis into U's. So we just do this conformal mapping or whatever mapping in the complex plane, and the circle becomes this path in the complex planes. This is the real axis, and this is the axis, parallel to the real axis shifted by pi, I pi. And then it turns out that if you just rewrite the infinitesimal RG step, you can write it as what? As a, you calculate the average increment of those UJs when you add a small slice. Average is done here, you know, the averaging over the added slice. And then, so you express the change of the UJs given for a wire of length L in terms of when you add a small slice of length delta L. And you find what? You find that instead of having a constant motion of the phi around the circle, you have now some motion that is controlled by a force, which is given here. Okay? So it means that the particle U, due to the energy epsilon, simply increases in speed very fastly as it goes to large epsilon, or when it is starting at when it is around here. So you fix epsilon. If U is very negative, there is a very strong force from the Koch, and then the force diminishes and then increases again. And once you reach the infinity here, you jump on this side because the tension here is can be negative. So you have to include an I pi shift to get a negative exponential. And so that's the effect of the energy alone. It's a wind that becomes very strong at the end of this path here, or here and here. And it's always going like that. Now, all the U's, they interact. Due to the disorder, this Brian motion gives you interactions among the U's. So here, Xi is the, what will be the crossover length scale induced by the disorder, the localization length for even under even numbers of chains. And you see that all the U's interact. Now the interaction is a hardcore interaction if the U's are on the same branch, but it is a softcore interaction if the U's are on a different branch. And then if you calculate the variance of the little delta U's, then you find that it is a constant number. And that's why I chose to represent this Brian motion, not in the phi language, but in the U language, because here I have a constant diffusion. So let's now look at, analyze intuitively this violent motion for the case of n odd and even. So this by this figure, I am trying to give you an intuition that the case of n odd always reduces to the case of n equal to 1. Why is it so? Well, imagine that you have n odd, put half of the particles to minus infinity, but very far from each other, put the other half particle to plus infinity I pi here, again very far from each other, and then because m is odd, you are left with one stupid guy who is sitting here. If you just look at this force, because if he's sitting at zero, the net force coming from the repulsive force coming from those guys cancels the repulsive force coming from those guys.
Is that the same as saying that I start off doing RG in this matrix R, which has a large number of parameters, but in the end it reduces to n equals one or one parameter scaling? And I've chosen to take some parameter R rather than the conductance. Like when you do RG in this large number of parameters, are you saying that one?
Well, what large numbers of parameters? What
about? Well, I mean, R is a matrix, right?
Yeah.
And so I just mean, if you believe in the gang of four, then you believe in one parameter scaling in the conductance, at least in the universal limit. Are you saying that this is, that that's violated in these systems, or does it just come back?
No, it is. I mean, here my parameters are Xi. I have only one parameter, which is Xi and beta for the symmetry class.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought the RG flow was. What is the RG flow in then? It's a spinning.
So I'm looking at my, so I'm increasing the system size, and I'm looking at how the reflection matrix behaves on the change of the system size.
Right,
but the statistical properties of R to begin with were only characterized by two parameters, beta and xi.
Okay, the statistical properties of R.
Yeah, yeah. So now what happens is that I have this particle here. From the point of view of the force here, it doesn't feel anything, but there is Brownian motion. There is it diffuses. So as soon as it moves from the middle here, it's going to start feeling the force of those guys and those guys. And if I were this guy, so what happens is that with some probability, this guy might move too far, and once it reaches, it goes here. Let's say it goes here, this force is going to become very strong because it's a curve, so this force is unbounded, whereas this is, so this force will always be larger than the repulsion coming from those guys, when the guy is here, because it's a subcore. This is subcore when from those guys to this guy here. So then this guy takes over, pushes this particle all the way to infinity, and then you are supposed at infinity to jump here. You jump here, but now you repel. Now it is not a softcore, but a hardcore repulsion. So then you push this guy here, and this guy is going to be pushed, and violent motion goes stay here, and then up, you go there, and poof, it jumps there. So that's how, okay, n odd equal to n1. And even, obviously, you don't have this situation, because here particles are stuck. Half of them go here, half of them go here, and well, you're kind of stuck in this situation, except with some probability, due to violent motion, those two particles start moving, and up they cross each other, they start repelling, and then they go there, and then the wind takes over, and they jump on this side. Okay, and now you can see intuitively why there is a big difference between the density of state in the n odd case and the n even case, because here you kind of are mostly stuck, and very rarely you are going to be allowed to have two particles doing a cycle, in which case you count one state going one more state in the system. Whereas here, this is much more likely because this guy doesn't feel any force on average close to the origin. So that's for the density of state, and then you trust me, you can use a very simple argument, then you can do a calculation by truncating this very difficult problem to a problem of diffusion between two, a reflecting wall and an absorbing wall for one particle, and you just, now the system, the length of the finite system is simply obtained by matching this with that. So now you have, you replace this guy here by diffusion here. This is a perfectly hard wall, this is perfectly absorbing wall. The length is U max, which is proportional to log over one energy, okay? And that's because as soon as this is much bigger than that, then you essentially go to infinity and you complete the cycle. And then once you have U max, then you ask the question, what is the inverse time to go from here to here? And then we know that's a diffusive process, so you use this as a diffusion constant. So you get 1 over xi, and then you have to multiply by u max square, which is 1 over, proportional to log square 1 over epsilon, and then you differentiate with energy, and you get the Dyson singularity. So now everything is valid for this continuum model. And I was telling you, believe me, there is universality in the problem, but this, why, is it right or not? And the only way to prove that, well, to prove it, is to compare with numerics. That's the, I cannot prove that there is universality. I can only hope there is. And then I can check after the fact if it is indeed so by comparing with a very different microscopic model. So the microscopic model was nearest neighbor hopping solved numerically, okay? And then what we want to check are those predictions here for the density of state. So what we have done is to calculate, well, first this upper panel has odd n, and then the symmetry, there are two symmetry classes that are depicted here. Time reversal symmetry and spin rotation symmetry is in blue. If you have unitary case, when you have break time reversal symmetry, you have the red color code. And then what you see is that indeed you have a diverging density of state for n equal to 1, n equal to 3, n equal to 3, a beta 1 and 2 here, the three cases. Is it this type of diverging density of state? Then what you do is that you multiply this by, you calculate the density of state, multiply the epsilon times, takes the 1 over, 1 over this object. So this is supposed, if you do a log-log plot, you should see a straight line by doing this plot like that. And you see we did it from 10 minus 7 to 10 to the minus 3 in energy. Mm-hmm. And then we have fairly good straight lines. So that seems to work. And then let's look at this interesting case. So here, if beta is equal to 2, you expect to have a suppression of the density of state. Beta equal to 2 is this color code here for n equal to 1. And n equal to 2 and n equal to 4. So that seems to work. But if beta is equal to 1, when you have time reversal symmetry and spin rotation symmetry, then this is gone, and you should see a logarithmic divergence. in blue, n equal to 2, beta equal to 1, or here n equal to 4, beta equal to 1, and indeed you see something that diverge. Is it this log? Again, you do a logarithmic plot, and it looks roughly, yeah, it seems okay, well, not too bad at least. So, I didn't explain to you why we had the log. So for the case of n equal to 2, we truncate our full Brownian motion to this problem. Here you have hard wall for particle 1. So we reduced n equal even to n equal to 2. So you have particle 1, you have particle 2. So they are pushed by those walls. Otherwise, they diffuse. And you impose another set of boundary conditions. Whenever they hit each other on the line, they disappear. They are absorbed. Okay? And that's a cycle that is being completed. Now the question is, we want to estimate the time for those two particles to meet. So if you estimate the time, then you get two factors. You have to decide where they're going to meet. And once you decide where they're going to meet, you get this contribution. But the point is that there is a degeneracy where they're going to meet. And here the length is again u max, which is a log. And the degeneracy tells you that you have to multiply the result, the time by this, all the possible way. Well, they can meet here, 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 and that's how you get this log here. So as long as the center of mass of those two particles is not pinned to some special value, you will get this log. But that can be changed by the macroscopic. So if you work with random flux problem for two chains, center of mass is pinned, and then this log is gone. So you can say in some sense that that depends from that depends on the details.
It's only the strongest order limit, shouldn't it? With two chains, I mean, presumably maybe where your continuum theory is invalid because the disorder is so strong.
Yeah.
One would have thought it would go to the random matrix result with one non.
Then you have to use a different technique. I mean, our approach is not valid.
Numerically, you can check.
You can test numerically, or you can use real space RG methods, maybe, and check that. I don't know the answer. I don't know if, our numerics have, I don't know that.
I think disorder is pretty strong.
Yeah. My guess is that it survives the I think that you have to be careful when you take the Germanic limit when you say that random matrix theory applies. I think you can have non-universal corrections to random matrix theory. That's my bet, but didn't check that explicitly. Okay, let's look at the conductance now. So for the conductance, let's go back to our reflection matrix. Our reflection matrix is not unitary anymore for the conductance, but because of the sublattice symmetry, there is still a special symmetry obeyed by this reflection matrix. Reflection matrix at epsilon is equal to the adjoint at minus epsilon, the energy. So a priori, this is not going to do anything to you when epsilon is finite. But when epsilon is equal to zero, R is now a Hermitian matrix. So if it is Hermitian at the band center, then it has the real eigenvalues that you can write as tangent hyperbolic of xj. So j runs from 1 to n, where n is numbers of chains. Note that eigenvalues are changed by xj going to minus xj. Well, what would you do if you were to work at finite energy? Well, then what really enters in the conductance is r dagger r, which is a Hermitian positive matrix. So let's write all the eigenvalues of r dagger r as tangent hyperbolic square of xj, where j runs from 1 to n, the numbers of chain. Now, those eigenvalues are unchanged when you go from xj to minus xj. So now, if you do this parametrization, the conductance is given by this formula here. And now you can play exactly the same game as for the density of state. We are going to look at what happens. How do the xj change when I add a small slice of this order? And instead of giving you the answer in terms of this Brownian motion, this differential version of the Fokker-Planck equation, I'll give you the Fokker-Planck equation. And the Fokker-Planck equation is in red for the band center and in blue away from the band center. And this is a change of the joint probability distribution of the xj in a given system for a dirty wire of length L, expressed in terms of something here, and the something depends on the Jacobian, which is given here. And the difference between this and this is the Jacobian. At the band center, we get this red Jacobian. Away from the band center, we get this blue Jacobian. And this is now what is essential, the essential difference between this and this Jacobian, well, there are two, well, there's an essential difference is the property, what happens to the Jacobian when Sj goes to minus Sj. When Sj goes to minus Sj for a fixed J, then you have no symmetry here. But when Sj goes to minus Sj for any fixed J alone, then this is symmetric. So this has more symmetry than that, if you want. And this tells you what? This tells you the fact that you have this cinch. When you do the differentiation, it gives you, it brings you an interaction among the xj's. And the interaction is going to be like a tangent hyperbolic. So it means that it doesn't, or cotangent hyperbolic. So it doesn't like at all having sj at the same point. Okay? So the xj repel from each other, from the Jacobian. But here, the xj is also repelled from minus xj. Well, the xj repelled from minus xk, where j is not equal to k due to this term here. And due to this term here, xj repelled from minus xj. And that's essential. This term, this difference, the fact that there is no, the xj don't repel from minus themselves, and this is a Jacobian, but they do here, is the reason why we're going to get delocalization for the random hopping problem and for the superconducting quantum wire, which I have not talked about yet, but everything carries through for those guys. So again, the theory gives at the band center this Jacobian, away from the band center this Jacobian. So let's look at what happens when you have this Jacobian. As I said, all the xj repel from xk, so we don't like to be close to each other. Now for n even, what happens is that they all repel from each other, and they all flow to infinity as you increase the length of the system. Now, the conductance is is proportional to, well, is one channel gives you a contribution of 1 over cos square of xj. So if the xj scale like L, as you increase the length of the wire, then you get exponential localization. And this is the case for n even at the band center. But n is odd, you get one stupid guy that sticks to the middle. And then all the other guys go to infinity here and to minus infinity here, and the net force on this guy is zero. On average, this guy is close to zero. And it just fluctuates randomly around this position. So this is the guy that is going to give you this anomalous contribution to the conductance that results in this enhancement of the conductance, and also in the fact that log of G is not self-averaging anymore. Now, epsilon not equal to zero, you have to distinguish the case where you have now the xj repel from each other, but they also repel from their mirror image, and especially they repel from their mirror image. So this guy repel from this guy and from this guy. But the fact that everybody repels from each other forces the all those guys not to stay at x equal to at the origin of the real line. And then you are guaranteed to have exponential localization. So what's the time?
1 o'clock.
How much?
It's 1 o'clock. Maybe you try to finish in 5-10 minutes.
5-10 minutes. So again, now we have predictions. We have to check against numeric to see the universality assumptions that we implicitly made is valid. And very quickly, the point is that those are all checks, so you have to trust me, they are all true. So maybe this is not, this is too long, well, it's simply not the most impressive check. So the most impressive check of universality is for the random flux problem. Random flux means a hopping amplitude is a pure phase and the phase is random. Now you can actually solve the Fokker Planck equation exactly for this case. And then what you find is that you find exact result for the moment for average of G, for the moment of G, for the variance of G. And then you can check against numerics. Until now, I was always talking about the physics in the localization regime where the length scale of the wire when L is much larger than localization length, but those results are valid at all length scale for the continuum model. And what I want you to notice is in red is N equal to 15, and this is a decay of the conductance that is algebraically fast. Actually, it is like square root of 1 over L, and this is a log-log plot to illustrate that. And this is in blue, N equal to 16, this is a decay which is exponentially fast. Now, when you look at the variance, for large L, you find again a decay like 1 over square root of L here in red, and exponential of L here in blue. But look at this beautiful non-perturbative result in the diffusive regime. Diffusive regime means Xi is larger than L. And you see that the exact result is in black here. And you see that here there is a complete, this even odd effect is completely non-perturbative if you come from the, if you do perturbation theory in a diffusive regime. You never see it. So, very quickly, I talked about universality. So, in a diffusive regime, when the length of the wire is smaller than the localization length, in a standard quantum wire, you find that what you find is that there is a correction to the classical Deruda calculation, which is finite and independent on the microscopic details, except for the symmetry class beta. That's what you will find. You will find a finite number here when L goes to, well, the ratio of L Z by Xi goes to infinity. And it turns out that for the chiral quantum, and this is called weak localization. And this is not present in the chiral wire. So when S goes to infinity, where S is this ratio here, this is the ratio. When S goes to infinity, this goes to zero, absence of weak localization corrections. This is true for the conductance, for the short noise. Now, if you look at what is called universal conductance fluctuations, which is the variance of G, what you find is that, what is important is 1 times something, which only depends on beta, and this is twice as large as in the standard quantum wire. So that's a difference with the diffusive regime. So we have calculated crossover in energy in the diffusive regime for the conductance, but no time. I would like to talk about dimerization, going back to some comment of Sentiel about the work of Ovchinnikov and Rickman. Now, the change, so here is the Fokker-Planck equation written in differential form for the conductance. Again, those are the radial coordinates of the reflection matrix. And this is the repulsion between the x, but the f is proportional to the dimerization. And f lacks like a constant wind. It's pushing all the x's in one direction. And what does it mean? What are the consequences of this wind due by dimerization? If you tune the dimerization from zero to some, so increase the value of f, what will happen is that you will find n transitions. You are going to reach n critical point at which the system is going to behave as if it was n odd without dimerization. Okay? And how do you check that numerically? Well, you just fix the system size, calculate the conductance in the presence of dimerization, and increase the dimerization. And what you see is that you should have exponential suppression of the conductance of away from the critical points, the n critical points where n is the number of channel, but then you will have enhancement of the conductance because they are now decays algebraically. And that's exactly what you see as you increase the dimerization. Depending on the number of chain, you're going to see n such bump in the conductance. So this is in striking analogy with dimerized quantum spin chains, which are problems of interacting spins without disorder when you put dimerization. Now, at this stage, since my title referred to the superconducting quantum wires, what's the relationship to the superconducting quantum wires? Or what this teaches us about superconducting quantum wires? So what is common between the random Hopping problem and the superconducting quantum wires is that all eigenvalues in a superconducting quantum wires come in pairs. And this interplay of localization physics and level repulsion reappears in the superconducting quantum wire. Now, in superconducting quantum wires, you have 4 universality classes depending on whether you have spin rotation symmetry and time reversal symmetry. And it turns out that the 2 classes of quantum wires, superconducting quantum wires, where the spin rotation symmetry is broken, behaves in the same critical way as the random Hopping problem with an odd numbers of chains. And for the same reasons as for the random Hopping problem with an odd numbers of chains, namely the Jacobian for those Fokker-Planck equations doesn't have this level, these repulsions of xj with minus xj, if you want. So that's the physics behind it. There is no mirror symmetry. Well, there is no repulsions from xj with minus xj. There is repulsion from xj with minus xk and plus xk, but not with minus xj. So the point is that you are allowed to have a particle, one of those fictitious particles can sit at the origin of the axis and give you anomalously large contribution to the conductance. So that's essentially the end of the talk, and here is a summary.
Thank you.
two questions. First is, do you have any theoretical understanding of why neural network chains?
I don't. Alex Alton has one.
Yeah, somebody has one.
Not published.
Really?
Not published.
Okay. Okay, second question was, I mean, 2D, if you have a 2D square lattice or some lattice with only looking from one sub-lattice to the other, then again, I guess various people have looked at that problem and just, you have some sort of critical state in the band center that's
yes.
diverging.
Yes.
Density states and so on. Again, would you expect that if you have a bilayer or something, that that criticality is washed out in you?
No, I don't expect that. I think this is special to quasi 1D. I think it's very special to quasi 1D. So this effect, our calculation, first of all, is strictly quasi one-dimensional. There is no way in this model to ever describe a two-dimensional system. And evidently, on the way to two-dimensional physics, this even our effect has to disappear and give you the true two-dimensional physics. Now, I think that I don't think there is. When you have two layer, well, one layer, you have a critical state. When you have a in three dimension, you will have something special at the band center. Also, when you go from two to three, I don't think you will have disappearance of this critical state. But I didn't say it, so.
I mean, you might think that if you go to the limit where the transverse hopping is the biggest thing,
yeah.
that you can see the difference between the even and odd, because then you wouldn't have any zero energy.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so for the same for the two layer, if I first went to the limit yeah. where the interlayer hopping was yeah. big, you would kill the zero
yeah.
energy state.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's another way of understanding. That's another way of understanding this even odd effect, so simply by focusing first on the rungs and then solving the problem of the rungs first, and you have a zero mode, and imagine that the zero mode now propagates. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But then, well, you have to propagate like that and like that. So.
So it's easier to localize in two layers because of this. But can you localize in one layer in two dimensions?
Sorry?
If you suppose in linearization on the lattice.
Yeah, no, but you don't do that. If you just start.
Well, you can't even localize really in one dimension, so how can you localize it? It must be harder in two dimensions to localize.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, so you would need some dimerization, something like.
No. Field theoretic analysis of this problem in 2D, I thought in 2D you again got a critical state, but with some other divergence for the density of state. But in 3D, I thought we're allowed to have a localized
at the band center?
At the band center?
No, I thought you allowed metal, isn't it?
Yeah, you have a
metal.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure, about that. In 2D, it's
maybe it seems like in 3D, you will have a metal. Near the band center, and then anything which will happen at the band center will be kind of it will be washed out by the metal behavior.
So it's always going to be metallic at the band center in 3D, is that?
Well, at the band center, I'm not sure what happens. I'm saying that it's every neighbor.
But that's the most natural scenario. Right? They have many critical points, and they merge into metal and such.
Like what's happening in this three-dimensional quantum world system. No, sorry. 3D, you'd have a metallic state in the center, near the center of the band, and then localized.
Yeah.
But if you crack up the dirt, could one?
Yeah. So we'll get rid of
the
strong, if the disorder is if the disorder is very strong, you won't have metallic state even in 3D. Then the question is the
critical state.
Yeah, because this seems to be a property of even strong disorder, although we do have it in the weak disorder limit. But I mean, from the RG, real space RG point of view, you are even better off if you start with very strong disorder. And the Dyson solution, which is true for a huge class of distributions, among others, very broad distribution. So if this is really a property even of strong disorder system, maybe you kill the metallic state by cranking the disorder strength, and then you are left with the physics of the band center, which is very special.
goes the other way in 2D from the argument you were making, which is that in 1D, as soon as you, if you think in this real space RG picture, as soon as you make dimers, you force the interactions between spins that are divided by those to be very weak. Mm-hmm. Whereas in 2D, if I start pairing things up, there are always ways to go around, or in 3D, so it's not so obvious that the residual interactions between far away sites have to be so weak.
It's not obvious that you couldn't localize in 2D?
Yeah, well, it's that weakness of the remaining interactions that's responsible for almost delocalized state at zero energy, or the piling up of the density of states, exactly. But you would think that they needn't be quite as weak in 2 or 3D.
Presumably your RG would also work if you took stacks of, say, two leg ladders, right? And you could try to see, so if you want to ask Senthil's question about taking a stack of 2D planes, you could first take a stack of 2D, two-leg ladders, first one leg, two-leg ladder, then, it's still a finite size system, so you could see whether there is, it's in a sense the same way as you said, that you would take a one, you would try to see if there's an even or not.
Well, but if it's, if it is pairs of ladders, it's always going to be even, right?
No, it's even, right, so it's even, so if you started from a 1D system, and on the way to 2D, there is this odd and even effect. But now if you start with a pair of ladders, with a ladder, and ask, is there this odd and even effect on the way to the 2D system? You think?
So you're saying you take a ladder, you solve this problem, and then you take another one like that, and then you couple it. Yeah, but then you have even the numbers of chains.
No. So you said there's a difference between 15 and 16 legs.
Yeah.
What I'm asking, do you expect there to be a difference between 15 times 2 and 16 times 2?
No.
Why not?
I don't think so. I mean, you always end up with, if you do it like that.
15 times 2, I don't mean just 30 and 32. I mean 15.
But that's, isn't it the same thing?
Well, I mean, if you ask about a two-dimensional problem that corresponds to it, then it has further neighbor hoppings, which breaks your...
Are you putting sort of infinite range hopping?
In the transverse direction.
The transverse direction. So your technique want you to. Your technique couldn't.
Yeah. But what he's saying, what we are saying, if you understand it is true, our model tells you that the way you, as long as you're in quasi 1D limits, it doesn't matter if you...
Sure. Anyway, maybe we should...